Daniel walking among the lions must be one of the great Bible stories. There's so much there to catch children's attention. You think through at least biblical history of lions and the encounter with a lion by someone such as David was this great victory. A great trust in God, a great ability, a great warrior to be able to go face a lion. And when he faced Goliath, that became one of the, one of his bases of confidence in God, is God had enabled him to defeat a lion. Lions weren't evidently a typical thing that people defeated very easily, and especially one-on-one. And so if out in, quote, the wild, that it takes a group of people organized to defeat a lion, what is the situation when you're put in the lion's den? When you're put in a cave where no place to run, there is no escape, and you are their meal. It seems unlikely that people would keep lions in a den for the purpose of punishment and regularly feed them and make sure they're well kept and happy and content. The whole purpose, and this was a very cruel thing of the Persian Empire, lions were there to devour. This was to be a cruel, a horrible death. The only thing that possibly could have made this any worse was if they would have had steel cages and it could have been something out on display. But because of the time and the setting, it was, more like a cave, underground cave. And as we'll see in the story, nobody's watching because it's sealed from the top and it's just there. But Daniel in the lion's den, there are a lot of things that, while the story is well known, there are some things that, that stand out also in just the whole book. Because as we look at this, this becomes a story about a man that's faithful. Faithful against, you say great odds, but I don't know that there are any odds. I suggest that if you, put one of these events on and you said we've got this group of lions, we've got the, several lions down here, four or five lions, and we put them in this pit and we haven't fed them for a week, and we're going to throw somebody down there. And you go to Las Vegas, say, exactly what are the betting odds? I'm not sure that they put betting odds on that one. They seem to be able to find a way to bet on anything. Super Bowl is most fascinating because they have bets on how long that national anthem is going to be. They have bets on when the first commercial will take place, when the first penalty will take place. You can bet on about anything, evidently, with the Super Bowl. But I don't think there would be any odds. Or would you survive a night in a lion's den? This is as certain death could be. And yet, as we see in this story, not only did Daniel have a different perspective, the king had his question about it. I don't know that the king had what you'd call confidence, but he had a question. He knew it was a possibility. And that makes this king quite different than King Nebuchadnezzar that we saw in chapter 2. There are some intriguing parallels in Daniel chapters 2 through 7. It's an interesting progression. It's not all chronological, even though most of it is chronological. Of chapters 2 through 7, all deal with in a time of Babylon's kingdom, except for chapter 6. So chapter 7 is not in chronological order. It occurred earlier. Therefore, they all deal with, they deal with three different kings. The first chapters, chapter 2, 3, and 4, have to do with Nebuchadnezzar. Chapter 5, as we saw last week, was Belshazzar. And chapter 7 is him also. But then this one has to do with the Persian king, Darius. Daniel's age through these chapters, obviously as they progress in time, or span. Daniel in chapter 2, while we don't have a definite date, if we give a date to Daniel, an age, and say that he's 16 when he was taken into captivity, and obviously you have to give a, give or take some years because we don't know, but let's say if he was 16. It seems to me, and there's nothing in the text to tell us, but chapter 2 occurs pretty soon. Say it occurs 3 years after he's been in Babylon. Daniel's about 19 when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego face a similar situation when they will not bow down to the image that Nebuchadnezzar has created. Well, now we move forward, and it's in a time when Darius is king. And Daniel would have been approximately 82 years old when Media-Persia captured Babylon. So the question then becomes, how much later did this chapter occur? It would seem to me it occurred very quickly. So let's say it occurred during the next year. Daniel's somewhere around 83 years old. Most of us, when we looked at children's stories, or if we're, you know, looked at those pictures, seldom are you going to see a picture of an 83-year-old man in the den with lions. Those that took the time to really think about the chronology would do it. But, you know, my picture of it was always, you know, if Daniel had a stick, he could have probably beat off those lions. He was a young, strong, you know, this warrior kind of a guy. But now he's 82, 83 years old, 85, somewhere in that range. When you look at what's going on that in chapter 2, Daniel was called in to tell the king the dream and its interpretation. And it was about this mysterious dream. And as the dream unfolds and Daniel interprets it, it gives a scope of all of Gentile history. Chapter 7, Daniel has a dream and an angel comes to interpret the dream and it gives the scope of Gentile history. And so sandwiched in these two, this block of literature from 2 to 7, you know, on the ends, like bookends, is a scope of Gentile history. Chapter 3, we see the men of God are persecuted. Nebuchadnezzar comes up with his great idea. Say, hey, I'm going to make a statue. I'll have everybody bow down to it. You know, this is wonderful. He gets into this concept, and it's all about his ego, but it's, you know, this idea of worship, and these men of God stand firm. They're faithful. Chapter 6. We have the same kind of thing, other than Darius is not about honoring himself. He's kind of suckered into this thing. But it's a similar thing that the man of God, Daniel, this time, is set out for persecution. And so as you look at this, you have on the very ends the history of the Gentiles, scope of history. Then you move in and you see men of God persecuted and man of God persecuted. And then you move into those middle two chapters, 4 and 5, and it has to do with judgment. Both of them are the judgment. You have a vision of a tree. And that's the judgment that will come on Nebuchadnezzar because he has elevated himself way too high. And then we see the handwriting on the wall, and that is a judgment that comes upon on Babylon at the very end, and that's the end of Babylon. And so these chapters are very, very much parallel in the way they go. The scope of Gentile history going from shown us that we see in 2 and 7 through the visions, it is, we might even see in this, it's Gentile power in action. Remember, Israel has been a nation for quite some time, and they've been at times under Solomon, they were, you know, the greatest nation in the world. They should have always been under some type of a leader, not a king, because God should have always been their king, but they rebelled against that concept and wanted a king. But now, not only is God not their king, not even a Jew is their king. they're being governed by a Gentile. And God establishes in this, it's the Gentile power in action, the scope of these nations, but with its definite limitations before God. The Gentiles are really not in control, even though they may think they're in control. God is in control. And then we see this aspect of God's sovereignty. So, with God's sovereignty, they come along and Nebuchadnezzar says, okay, everybody has to bow down when the horn sounds and worship my image, or the image I've created. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they refuse to do that. And Nebuchadnezzar says, no one, no God can deliver you from my hand. It's not possible to escape the punishment that's going to come upon you. However, he comes to realize that their God is a God who can deliver. Then you move in that parallel, almost a parallel chapter, in chapter 6, Darius, not so much that he starts out to have everybody worship him, but he's kind of suckered into this proclamation about that you cannot worship, you cannot pray to any other god for a month. And it's a similar situation. He's never claiming it's not possible for no God to deliver. Actually, he kind of holds hope that Daniel's God will deliver him. But the point is, it's not a normal situation you can escape from. And he recognizes fully that Daniel's God is God who delivers. God is sovereign. He's sovereign in that situation. And then in both chapters 4 and 5, as Nebuchadnezzar comes to realize, and as the end of Babylon and Belshazzar comes to recognize, is that Yahweh is not only sovereign over those that are faithful to Him, being able to deliver them, He is sovereign over kingdoms. He sets up kings. He takes down kingdoms. And so in this chapter, it has many parallels to chapter 3, where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refuse to bow down to the idol, the image that Nebuchadnezzar set up. They were found faithful. They did not go into the fiery furnace with some great confidence that they would walk out. But they went into it knowing if it was God's will, they would walk out. Because they had full confidence that their God was able. He just hadn't revealed to them His plan. And so their statement is, we know He is able. We don't know if He will, but we know He's able. Therefore, we will not bow down to your image. Nebuchadnezzar was out to prove a point. In this chapter, the king is not trying to prove a point. He found himself in a bad situation. Well, the chapter begins with Daniel's distinction in the nation because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. Now, when did this chapter actually occur historically? We don't know. But it sure seems like it would have occurred immediately after Media-Persia captured Babylon and took over. Daniel, if you'll recall, said he didn't want the reward that King Belshazzar would give, which the king said, anybody can interpret the handwriting on the wall, he'd make him third in all the kingdom. And most likely the reason for being third is that the kingdom was under a co-regency. He was a co-king with his father. And so third would have been the next highest position under the king. And Daniel, perhaps it would seem, said he didn't want that because Daniel wasn't doing this for what someone could pay him, but he was doing this as a servant of God. On top of that, perhaps Daniel also was going, I really don't want to be third because I can read the inscription and this kingdom isn't going to exist tomorrow. And, you know, when new kings come in, they kind of get rid of those top people. And I'd just soon not be associated with you. That makes it even more remarkable that Daniel is recognized and put in a position of power. How did he come to be known? Perhaps as they came in and captured the kingdom and stories were told. We knew it was going to end tonight. Perhaps, and I know of no reason why it wouldn't be, the handwriting's still on the wall and someone is pointing at Daniel. Read that. He said this was the end of the kingdom. For whatever reason, and we're not given that reason, we know ultimately the reason is because God said this is what we're going to do. But Daniel is put in a position of great power. Chapter 6, verse 1. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 160 satraps over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom. And over them, three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them and that the king might not suffer loss. And so he came up with a system of government. Okay, I'm going to have 120 people that are scattered around and they're responsible for overseeing certain things. And then I'm going to put three people in charge of those 120. And so we can assume that it's kind of divided up and you've got 40 people here that one person's over and 40 that another one's over. And so they're set up in those kinds of setting. However, verse 3, then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and the satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. And the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Daniel possessed an extraordinary spirit. He possessed an excellent spirit. Now, that's not to mean that he possessed a great attitude, which obviously he had to have. But this idea of an extraordinary or excellent spirit kind of goes back to what we saw earlier. He had great abilities. He was endowed by God. He had, if you would, spiritual gifts that enabled him to function at levels that nobody else was functioning at. And very much along the line of Joseph, back in the great Genesis story, where Joseph was in Egypt, and it didn't matter if Joseph worked for somebody, if Joseph was in jail, if Joseph was under the king, Joseph just kept advancing because God enabled him. So Daniel is distinguishing himself, and Daniel, not only is at this high position of being one of the top three advisors and appointees under the king, but the king is going to redo the structure and put Daniel over all those three who are over these. Daniel has quickly risen once again to the top. And remember, while we don't know the exact time period, Daniel was, maybe 60 years old, somewhere around 60 years old, when Nebuchadnezzar died. And Daniel apparently went off the scene, forced into retirement. So perhaps Daniel has been retired for 20, 25 years, not of his own choosing. And all of a sudden, Daniel is the most powerful person in the kingdom under the king. So the next part of this is a plot to destroy Daniel is set in motion by those who possess a jealous spirit. Well, Daniel had an extraordinary spirit. There are those that are jealous. They see somebody being advanced over them and they're not happy. Verse 4, then the commissioners and satraps begin trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful in no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Now, not really as meant to be a anti-political statement, but I think you'd be hard pressed to do that today in our nation. I mean, even those that are, quote, you know, really honorable people, that there's no ground of accusation, no ground of corruption, nothing to, you can't even come up with a story to make them look bad. So verse 5, they say, "We shall not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God." This Daniel, we can't find anything that he does where he's negligent, where he's corrupt, where he's immoral. You know, the only thing we can do is see if we can find some way to turn his allegiance to his God in a way that works to our advantage. Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him the following: "King Darius, live forever." All, notice that word all the commissioners of the kingdom. There's three commissioners. You can assume two of them are present. Daniel's not there. All the commissioners, all the officials, all the governors, everybody, the whole kingdom has gotten together on this. King, we're telling you, everybody that serves under you is in on this. We've all got together, had this great conference, and we think this would be a wonderful, wonderful idea. Everybody's in agreement. You know how hard it is to get everybody in agreement on anything? Everybody's in agreement. Of course, they leave Daniel out. Why are they all in agreement? Because they're all jealous of Daniel. He's an outsider. And he's going to be over them. And what we think you ought to do, King, they say, is, middle of verse 7, should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O King, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O King, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. And that's one of the things we see in the book of Esther, that the Medes and Persians had this set up, that once a law was passed, that law had to be enforced. The law had to be enforced. Therefore, King Darius signed the document, and so we have a new law in the land. For the next 30 days, here's this image. The implication is that this image is to be worshipped, but clearly no other god is to be prayed to, worshipped during these 30 days. But notice the king, while he definitely has an ego issue, I mean, he's still going to let them make an image. Doesn't necessarily say the image is of him, quite like it is to Nebuchadnezzar, but that's the clear implication. And that you're setting aside every, you know, all other forms of worship except this one. It's not the king that came up with it. And the king was told that everybody was in agreement. Of course, everybody was in agreement except one. Well, verses 10 to 15, Daniel stands faithful even in the midst of evil men. Now, when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now, in his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. Now, let's be, you know, I mean, it's one thing to, you know, read a story about Daniel and say, well, that's what he did, and we know the ending. But assume for the moment we don't know the ending. And there's no mandate that the way you worship Yahweh is go up to a high visible window and face Jerusalem. I mean, it's not as though this is the only way Daniel could obediently pray. I mean, he could have left the doors closed. He didn't have to be on the highest room. He could have gone down to a low floor and faced Jerusalem if he wanted to face Jerusalem. There's nothing that he had to face Jerusalem. I mean, this is his practice. But it's not that this was the prescribed way it had to be done. So what are you going to tell Daniel? Daniel, this is a crummy law, but it's only 30 days. Now, for 30 days, just don't open your windows. For 30 days, if you really need to be facing Jerusalem right outside of town, if nothing can be between you and Jerusalem, go find a deserted place. I mean, I can imagine all the great wisdom we would have been able to share with Daniel. And we said, well, you know, God doesn't say it has to be this way. It's not like you're going to be denying God if you do this, because it's not, you know, it'd been one thing if God said, this is the only way you can pray to me, but God did never say that. But this is who Daniel was. This is what he's been doing. If this is what you've been doing to change, is to cave in. And Daniel, he just went about it. You know what's so interesting in the text? It's so clear. It says, Daniel knew. Daniel's aware. Daniel's aware of what the new law is. Daniel's aware of the new consequences. And Daniel's also aware, surely Daniel's aware, since when he asked the king about it or whenever he heard about it, oh, everybody's in agreement with this. And Daniel's going, nobody asked me. Surely Daniel's aware this is about him. Daniel opens his windows and prays. No change. Now, is that arrogance? I'm sure some would say it was. Some seem to always find something to say. But this is about a man that is going to be faithful no matter what. Does Daniel know that he will be delivered? I don't see how Daniel knows that. You know, to say Daniel knows that, then he had to have a revelation that wasn't disclosed to us. And that doesn't seem to fit the nature of the book. Does Daniel believe that his God is capable of delivering him? Yeah. Has Daniel personally experienced things that would suggest that his God would deliver him or could deliver him? Yeah. Does Daniel have memories of the stories of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Yeah. But that doesn't change the fact this is today. And if he opens those windows across the way in another building, you know, with their ancient video camera, and they're sitting there recording this to put on trial for Daniel. Daniel opens the windows. Verse 11, then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. Then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den? Well, I sure did. The statement is true according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be evoked. Then they answered and spoke before the king, Daniel, remember Daniel, king, who is one of the exiles from Judah. I don't know that Daniel really needed to be identified that way. They could have said, Daniel, you know, that guy that's one of the three that's at the very top and the one you were going to put at the very, very top. But here's the real issue. Daniel, he's one of them. He's not one of us. Exiles of the Judah pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. Well, you know, if you were the king, I'm assuming you're not just an idiot that has no concepts whatsoever. When one day people come and tell you, everybody's in agreement, and then the next day they come and they say, of the three commissioners, one's not following the new rules that he wanted you to, you know, 2 days ago he wanted you to make this law, but today he's not following it. You might figure out in a hurry, I think somebody lied to me. I think I've been had. Then as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. See, immediately he realized he'd been tricked. And he's like, okay, oh man, I can't believe I fell for this one. Oh, okay, how am I going to get Daniel out of this? I need Daniel. He's a good guy. I want Daniel. The rest of the day, he kept working, thinking through, how can I make this work? At the end of the day, verse 15, the men come back and they said, recognize, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and the Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed. The king tried all day to figure out a way to get around that. But at the end of the day, he knew he had been had. There's no way out. Well, in verses 16 to 23, Daniel is thrown at the lion's den, but was delivered because he possessed a trusting spirit. So in verse 16, the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought into the cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, notice the difference here between him and Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar says to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it is not possible for any god to deliver you from my hand. Darius, though, says, your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you. Now, where does Darius get that? Where does he get this kind of a concept? I mean, it took Nebuchadnezzar a long time to develop to a position where he had a view that Daniel's God was a sovereign God. I would think that's the very reason that Daniel was ever put into a position of power to begin with. And the reason he's advancing Daniel, or going to advance Daniel, is because he recognizes this. Darius is already buying into the concept that Yahweh is at least a top God. Daniel's been talking to him, I would assume. He knows something. He knows of Daniel. He knows of Daniel's faith. Something's different for sure. Nevertheless, Daniel is dropped into the den. A stone was brought in, laid over the mouth of the lion's den, and it's sealed. And it's sealed with the wax and the signet ring, so nobody's going to violate this. Nobody can let Daniel out. And there's no escape. Then the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and sleep fled from him. Here's a man that spent a long, restless night because he cared about Daniel. And he's got a thought, Daniel might survive. Daniel might be there. You can tell from his questions it's not an absolute. You know, he's not sleeping calmly through the night because he knows with great confidence that Daniel will be there. But he's wondering. Verse 19, and the king arose at dawn at the break of day and went in haste to the lion's den. When he had come near the den to the lion, he cried out with a troubled voice. The king spoke and said to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? And he hears from down below, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime. Then the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken out of the den. So Daniel was taken out of the den and no injury whatsoever was found on him. Reason? Because he trusted in his God. Daniel, we see when it begins, he has this extraordinary spirit. Here we see this trusting spirit. And all that is contrasted by this spirit of jealousy that those in opposition had. Well, the concluding verses, King Darius decreed that Daniel's God is the living God. First, the king takes out a little vengeance on those that tricked him. The king then gave orders and brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them and their children and wives into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then Darius the king wrote to the peoples, nations, men of every language, who were living in all the land, "May your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear, tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues, performs signs and wonders, and in heaven and on earth." Back in chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar is writing his decree after his years of insanity and coming to recognize that Yahweh is a sovereign God. Verse 2, he says, "It has seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. His dominion is from generation to generation." You see just this incredible parallel in what they're saying. Well, and then his very last part here, he talks about God delivering, the last part of verse 27, "who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions." After Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego survived the fiery furnace, chapter 3, verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own." Delivering God. A delivering God. The chapter ends with, "So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian." Daniel ends his life as a very prominent government official. These stories are fascinating, but when you start laying them out and you see some of the parallelism that's in Daniel, you see there's a very definite structure of what stories Daniel chose to put in his book, and that they are conveying similar truths at different points in history related to different kings. So here we have a different king under Media-Persia. This king is recognizing firsthand experience that Daniel's God is able to deliver. It's not so much that he doubted and is as arrogant as Nebuchadnezzar was, but nevertheless, it's shown there. And we see over this scope of this Daniel's life is this establishment in different kingdoms, or these two kingdoms, this very clear establishment, which we would then take by implication as true as it goes into the other kingdoms and throughout this times of the Gentiles, that Yahweh, Israel's God, is the one sovereign God who reigns. All kingdoms, all kings, somehow fit under him. that those that are faithful to Yahweh can be protected, even though they're not in Israel, even though they're not under that covenant position of a nation, in the land, they're still a covenant people protected by their God. You know, these are more than just intriguing Bible stories. This is a history, not of just Daniel, but a history of God revealing Himself to His people who are in captivity, that He still is God. He still is in charge. And as the Gentile kings have come to recognize, His kingdom is forever and ever and ever. Even if His chosen people are not in the nation, not in the land, not under their own king, it has not thwarted God's plan. Because you'd have to believe, if you were one as Daniel, taken out of Judah, taken to Babylon, you've heard that Judah has been destroyed, that the Jerusalem, the temple is not there, that the walls are torn down, burnt, nobody's really there anymore. You'd have to believe it was a nice run, but it's all over. Those were nice promises, but it didn't happen. You'd have to believe that unless you had this continual revelation from God that says, no, I haven't abandoned. This is a period of judgment. Remember, as Daniel will get back into it, remember I said, if you did this, I would do this. When I haven't left you, I still have my plans. I still have my plans, and I am the only one that truly is in charge. Daniel, whether it was at age, say, 16, when he's given the king's food, which we will make the assumption that the offense here was that this was offered to idols, and that's why Daniel wouldn't eat the choice food. It had been offered as a sacrifice to idols and the wine. And Daniel says, no, I'm not having anything to do with that. Just give me some vegetables and some water. At age 16, Daniel was faithful. At age 82, 83, Daniel is faithful. Both of those were in the face of death. Both of those were not what you do if you want to survive, if you want to progress. Both of those can be rationalized. And we could come up with all kinds of little wisdom to give both of Daniel when he's 16, Daniel when he's 82, of how to get around that situation. Daniel doesn't look to get around it. He just says, I'm not doing it. He just says, I'm going to do what I normally do. And what Daniel has is a relationship with the God of the universe that gives him the confidence to live his life as God directs. Would you stand with me as we close in prayer? Father, we thank You for Your revelation, for there's no way we can know these things if You didn't tell us. There's no way we could see the way You work in the lives of those that have gone before us if You didn't tell us. There's no way that we could know with such great confidence that there have been those before us that have trusted in You in what would seem extraordinary ways. But yet as we read their lives, it doesn't seem all that extraordinary. It just seems to be who they were. Help us to be those people. Those that walk with You faithfully. And we do pray in Christ's name.